Morning, class.
Morning.
How's everybody doing?
Good.
Kind of quiet today, aren't you? It's kind of loud there. Our last class for the semester? There's one more? Okay. This is my last one. I go home tomorrow morning, so. See my four grandsons and be there for the birth of my fifth grandson. All boys, yeah, isn't that great? Girls, yeah, they're okay. We need cheerleaders for the basketball team, so. We got five. We got five boys.
And one more extra.
I think we'll be good enough. We won't need any subs. So we can start having girls. Oh, Jeff, did you forget yours?
No.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad you can make it with us this week. Well, we're going to try to finish Search the Scriptures, huh? What did you guys do last week?
Project management,
huh? Was that fun? It was long? Was it all day? Just seemed like all day. Too much stuff, huh? Who taught that? Jay. From where?
Malay.
Oh, yeah, I know Jay. I just don't know last names. I have a hard enough time with Filipino first names. Okay, well, we did, last week, we finished what we call general hermeneutics. Remember, there are two different branches of hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is the science and art of biblical interpretation, and there are two broad categories. General hermeneutics, which deal with principles that relate to all scripture in all places, no matter what the genre is. And then special hermeneutics, which deals with the particular rules related to different genres. And that's what we'll talk about today. So we have a quote here to start with, rather lengthy quote, but it's from the Chicago Statement on Biblical Inerrancy. It says, awareness of the literary categories of scripture, that's genre, is essential for proper exegesis. The awareness of what kind of literature one is interpreting is essential to a correct understanding of that text. A correct genre judgment should be made to ensure correct understanding. A parable, for example, should not be treated like a chronicle, nor should poetry be interpreted as though it were a narrative. Each passage has its own genre, and the interpreter should be cognizant of the specific kind of literature it is he attempts to interpret it. Without genre recognition, an interpreter can be misled in his understanding of the passage. For example, when the prophet speaks of trees clapping their hands, one should not assume a kind of animism unless he recognizes this is poetry and not prose. So we'll look at a couple different kinds. The first one we'll look at is Old Testament narrative, and two reasons for that. Number one, narrative is the largest genre in Scripture. Genre takes up about 40% of the whole Scripture. And Old Testament narrative is the largest section of narrative. And there are unique rules related to Old Testament narrative as opposed to New Testament. And the second reason we'll do it is because the Hebrew writers developed a high level of literary skill in creating these narratives. And there's a lot to be learned and a lot that will open up the scriptures to you when you understand some basic narrative rules. It's really only been in the last 100 years that the discovery of this narrative form has been made by church and Christian and Jewish scholars. So there's a lot of material that's being written currently. Probably the best scholar is a man named Robert Alter, who's a Jewish man who has a unique background. He is a published scholar in two areas. Number one, the Hebrew language, especially the Old Testament language. He teaches University of California, Berkeley, one of the top academic institutions in the U.S. And he also is a published scholar in the area of comparative literature. So he's got the unique background of being a Hebrew scholar, Old Testament Hebrew scholar, and a literature scholar. So he combined those two skills, and he's written really the seminal books on Old Testament narrative. It's called Old Testament Narrative. Actually, there's a copy of the book in our library up here if you're interested, although it's written at a pretty scholarly level, so be prepared if you get interested. And so a lot of the information I've taken from him. So a few things about Old Testament narrative, a few basics. A narrative is a story and not a full biography. Not a full biography. It never tells us anything about the characters. In the 17th, 18th century, a new form of literature was developed, and that's the novel. And most of us, when we think about stories, we think about that kind of literature that was created 17th, 18th century, and it's pretty common now in most fiction writing, use that literature genre. So sometimes when we read Old Testament narrative, we think from that context, but Old Testament narrative is completely different than modern day contemporary novels or stories. And we have to remove a lot of our thinking process that we normally approach stories when we read Old Testament narrative. And one thing we're used to is biography. So in biography, you get lots of details that don't necessarily advance the story, but just provide local color or to make you feel like you're a part of the story. We don't get any of that in Old Testament narrative. Every detail that we get has a specific purpose. So we never get a description, like we don't know what Abraham looks like. Now, can you imagine a modern novelist writing a book and having a main character not giving you any information whatsoever about what this person looks like? Just would be unheard of, right? Or to read a biography about a famous person that didn't include details about their physical person. Unheard of. But that's what we get with Old Testament narrative. We only get biographical details when it's vital to the theological purpose of the author. Did you catch that? We only get biographical details when it is an important part of the theological purpose of the author. So when we get a biographical detail, we have to ask ourselves the question, why did the author tell us that about our character, and what was his theological purpose? What was the message from God he was trying to communicate? Because there's no such thing as just local color. There's no such thing as details that just make you feel a part of the story. Every detail has a purpose, has a theological purpose. So this is frustrating sometimes when we read Old Testament narrative because there's so much more we want to know. So many more details that we wish we had that the author doesn't give us. And we have to be content with the fact that every detail that we're given has a purpose. And every detail that's left out that we wish we had, it's left out for a purpose. So what we have is exactly what the human author and, of course, the divine author wanted us to know. Okay? Narratives also, you know, we like stories with happy endings. Movies that don't have happy endings don't do as well as the box office. Stories that don't have happy endings don't do as well. So we like happy endings. Narratives, Old Testament narrative, do not necessarily have happy endings. Matter of fact, if you read the book of 1 and 2 Kings, there's hardly any happy endings. Any temporary happy ending is always quickly followed by, but, and then we get some tragic detail. So don't look for happy endings. And characters often aren't presented as role models. Oftentimes we make a mistake, right? We look to these characters to find details about how we should live. But the grand purpose of the whole Old Testament is to show us the absolute inability of any human being to meet God's standards. And so sometimes we lift up people as role models, but we miss the whole purpose of the Old Testament. Is really what the Old Testament wants to tell us is this person is a wicked, fallen sinner. And even David, who is set as the quintessential seeker of God, right? And yet probably the greatest sinner of the Old Testament. And so we don't look to these people for role models. They point to Christ. We were looking at the other day a new series that's coming up on Daniel, from Daniel chapter 1 and chapter 2. And so someone was presenting Daniel chapter 1, how they wanted to do the story. And if you remember, you're familiar with the story of Daniel chapter 1. Daniel is, this is after the fall of Jerusalem, and they've been deported to Babylon, right? And so the Babylonian leaders, Nebuchadnezzar, one of the ways that you deal with a conquered nation is you get the leaders, especially the young people with potential, and you bring them into your court and you train them in your ways and you make them the apologist for your culture back to their own people, right? Which seems like a good strategy. And so Daniel and his three friends are brought in, and they desire to mold them and shift them to think like Babylonians. And so the premise of the sermon was that the world tries to press us into its mold, especially young people, because this is for our youth series, right? How the world tries to press young people by giving them new learning, thinking a different way, a new identity. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar changed their names, and a new something else, I can't remember. So far the sermon is looking, that's some good insight, right? Producing a nice little tension. But then the sermon went a little wrong, because then the goal was, see, Daniel made up his mind, right? Remember, they made up their mind not to eat the king's choice food. So the goal of the sermon was, let Daniel be our role model to show us, see, we're going to make a decision. We'll not be swayed by the ways of the world. But of course, the problem with that is, who's the hero of that story? Yeah, we become the hero. See, you make a quality decision, you're the hero, you stand strong against the world. And yet, all the Old Testament narratives are designed to show us our inability and to point to the real hero. You see? And so we made a slight adjustment. I suggested there's a passage in, kind of an obscure passage in Luke chapter 9, verse 51, when it talks about Jesus. He spent most of his ministry in Galilee. Did you know that? The three synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they write almost exclusively about his Galilean ministry. That's one of the reasons John later on decided to write his book, because John deals with Jesus' ministry in Jerusalem and Judea. These are separate provinces, okay? So think of Jerusalem and Judea as like Metro Manila, and Galilee as like northern Luzon or something like that. And so Jesus spent most of his ministry there in Galilee. But in Luke chapter 9, there's a change, and the Bible says, Luke says about Jesus, that he set his face towards Jerusalem. He set his face. Now, that's a Hebrew idiom that refers to making a quality decision. So, of course, what's ahead in Jerusalem? Yeah, the cross, right? And all the sorrow and the pain and everything he's going to experience. And yet, in the midst of much, much greater odds and much, much greater pressure than Daniel and his three friends experienced, Christ made a quality decision, you see? And so, what Daniel's decision, it points to the greater Daniel. And his ultimate decision against much, much greater pressure, he set his face to go and to take our sins upon himself for our redemption. Now, because of our greater Daniel, because of our hero, because of the quality decision he made, because of his death and resurrection, now we're empowered also to make a decision, you see. So that changes the whole sermon around. Now the end result is still we make a quality decision, but it's because of the greater Daniel, you see? And so that puts the emphasis on our hero. The real hero of the story is Jesus. Because he's the hero, now we're empowered with the ability to make a decision, you see? So often Old Testament narrative don't think of Old Testament characters as role models, right? Don't think of what should I learn and how should my behavior reflect the behavior I see here in these characters. What you have to think is, what does this character reveal about the greater one who would come? What do I learn about Christ? How do I worship Christ through this narrative? How is Christ the real hero? And so that takes a while to learn how to do that. But when you do, you begin to understand what the Old Testament narratives really are about. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Any questions? Tristan, you okay?
I'm okay. I'm just processing.
You're doing what?
Processing.
Okay. Because you got that look on your face like you're about to ask a question. So I thought I'd give you an opportunity here. Okay, great. Okay, number two, a few of the thoughts here. There are three elements to look for in narrative: plot, character, and dialogue. And we'll just explain those briefly. Plot, of course, is the arrangement of the incidents that make up the story, right? You know what plot is. That's that thing that summer action blockbuster movies don't have. Right? That's what plot is. What you don't get in any movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, all right, okay? No plot, we just get lots of incendiary devices and explosions and a high body count, right? Plot, though, is the arrangement of incidents that make up a story. And when we talk about plot, there are three elements. The background introduces the story. It usually identifies characters, their relationships, and positions in life. The Bible's mostly concerned about relationships. And so most of the background information that you get is related to relationships. We find out who this person is related to, the significant relations in their life, because that's what the Bible's primarily concerned about. That's how where life happens. So, for example, the Genesis narrative of Joseph, which is, along with Abraham, the longest narrative in the Pentateuch, and right behind David's narrative in total content. So Joseph gets as much airtime as Abraham does in the book of Genesis. And that narrative begins in chapter 37, right? When we're first introduced to Joseph. And remember, we learn some things about his relationships, right? What's the most important thing that we learn about his relationship? The most important relationship, the most important relationship fact we get about Joseph? What? his father's favorite. Yeah, that is the primary relationship that's going to frame this narrative all the way through to the end. So when a significant character is first introduced, you're looking for the relationships. What is the author choosing to tell you about the significant relationships in this person's life? Because that's the essence of the story. The next thing we have is the conflict. The conflict is the struggle the main character encounters. The conflict. And you can have a story without resolution. Did you see the movie Inception?
Yes.
Now see, that's a movie, it's a story that has no resolution. If you remember at the end of the movie, that little device is spinning, right? And we don't know, does it stop or does it keep spinning?
Right.
There's no resolution, but certainly there's conflict, so we have a story there. You can have a story without resolution, but you can't have a story without conflict. For example, Little Red Riding Hood packed a few goodies and went and saw her grandmother. That's not a story. When does it become a story? When the wolf shows up. Now we have a story, you see. Now we have conflict. So until you have conflict, you don't have a narrative. You don't have a story. And conflict can be external and internal also. And mostly the narrative tells you about the external conflict. You have to read between the lines to understand the internal conflict. Let's think about the narrative, the Joseph narrative. What's some of the external conflict in Joseph's life? Ethel, give me one example, external conflict in the Joseph story. Okay, yeah, his brothers, right? That's the first primary one, when his brothers throw him into the pit. Yeah? Claudette, what's another one? Another conflict in the Joseph narrative. Brothers, yeah, we got that one. And what's another famous one? A lot of people are whispering it to you. You just anyone? Potiphar's wife, yes, of course. That's a major external conflict, right? Some others. Harold, give me one more. Huh?
I think when the people are wanting to have supplies.
An administrator would think like that, wouldn't he? How are we getting the supplies to the people? Yeah, I don't think the Bible sets that as a conflict, but that's fascinating that you would think that. And good try, anyway. The last major conflict before we actually get to Egypt is with the baker and the wine tester, right? He's the one that forgets him. Yeah, so those are the external conflicts. But what's the internal conflict that's going on? Internal conflict. Sonny?
One is when the brothers came. Remember? When his brothers came to Egypt.
Yeah.
And turmoil inside of him. And he was, you know, whether to.
So what is the conflict, though?
The relationship.
Yeah, but what is the conflict? That's what I want to know. What's the emotion? What's the conflict?
Anger, bitterness, choosing to forgive or not. What choices?
Okay. Yeah. Possibly. You have to read the story pretty closely. What are some others? What's the internal conflict that he's dealing with when his brothers betray him?
Pride.
Pride? Explain that, Jeff.
For me, I felt like the reason why the brothers gang up on him is because they felt like he's the favorite of their dad.
Yeah.
So, and he sometimes tells them, like, I have a dream, and it felt like, you know, for the brothers probably he was too proud.
But what's Joseph's internal conflict? What's the battle he's facing?
The betrayal.
Tristan?
I think the idea of him...
It's okay, just talk, it's fine.
The idea of him having this vision from God and then he's having all these troubles from the moment he had the dream.
Yeah, so what's the conflict?
Having the promise of God, you know, having the promise of God happen now, but it took time.
Yeah, so it's unbelief, right? He's yeah. That's the pressure. Is he going to believe? Is he going to hold on to God's promises when it seems like he gets farther and farther away from the possibility of fulfillment? So these are the internal kind of temptations. Can he trust God when God's promise seemingly is impossible? It can't be fulfilled. It seems like God has failed. These are the real issues. The external conflicts just reveal or bring to light the internal conflict. That's where the story really happens. What's going on in the heart? What's he having to deal with? That's the conflict. And then there's the resolution. The conclusion of the story when the main issues are settled. So, of course, in the Genesis account of Joseph, it's when he's reunited with his family and they all move to Egypt, right? Look at a few other thoughts here now. Background narration. Background narration is supplemental information that provides clues to the meaning of the story. It does not move the story along, but provides explanatory and contextual information to help understand the story. Background narration usually introduces a new story. It covers principal characters, important geography, and habitual behavior, but it primarily introduces significant relationships. Now, I'm going to read this passage for you. It's background narration. And I want you to ask yourself, what do we learn in this background narration? What's the key element? There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophaim of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Joram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephrathite. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. So what's the most significant bit of background information we get here? This is the real obvious one. Hannah had no children, yeah. And a corollary to that is? Peninnah had children, yeah. There's also another bit of significant information that we won't find out how significant it is until later on, but that is Elkanah's hometown. We're going to find out later in the story why that's significant. At this point, it seems irrelevant to the story, but it actually becomes significant later on. Yes, honey?
Does it point to something when there's the son of the son of the son of the son of? Is there like significance in something like that when they mention? Because sometimes they don't talk about the son of the son of. You know, they just mention the guy's name.
Yes.
When it does, should you make note of that?
There are no unnecessary details. All right. Other pieces of background narration emerge at significant times during the plot. The Hebrew writers do not give you all the background information up front. Now, this is an interesting characteristic of Hebrew narrative. We're used to getting the background in the beginning of the story and then the story progressing from there. In Hebrew narrative, oftentimes, as the story is progressing, we get information that we might have expected to receive in the beginning. It's background narration that comes later on in the course of the story, but it's always introduced at a significant time in the story. So, for example, I want you to ask yourself this question as I read this text. Why am I learning this bit of background information about David at this point in the story? Now, David is first introduced in 1 Samuel chapter 16. And there's a lot of things that happen in that chapter. And then, of course, chapter 17, there's a lot of details up to this point. This is his first confrontation, when he first confronts Goliath. And the author tells us, and when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. Why am I learning this bit of information at this point? Harold?
Well, probably because it gives us an idea that David wasn't a warrior type in the way that, well, he's a youth, he's running, and if you are at that type, well, I'm just thinking that handsome in appearance means you have the battle scars, you have no disfiguration, which you have caused by a major battle.
Yeah. Do you know what ruddy means?
Red.
Yeah, red. Yeah. So he has a red complexion. He probably had red hair and a red complexion, right? Which in a Middle Eastern culture would really stand out, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It would be like a red-headed Filipino. That would stand out, wouldn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Why do we get that information here right at this point? You see, what do we find out about him? We found out he's a good-looking,
yeah,
red-haired boy.
Yeah.
Why? That's background information. That's who you need that in the beginning of the story. Why do we get it here? Well, the obvious reason is it adds incredible drama to the scene, right? Here is this hardened battle warrior and his first comment. And Robert Alter, in his commentary on 1st and 2nd Samuel, gives us a little bit more insight into the actual Hebrew here from his Hebrew scholarly background. Basically, what Goliath is saying is, it's a boy. Like shocked, like, this is all you got? It's a boy, and a red-headed pretty boy at that. Basically, he's mocking him, like, this is all you got? And so this adds tremendous drama to the story. And what does that drama highlight? What does that drama highlight? What? Contrast of what? Yes, Jenny, you're on the right track. Of Goliath and David. And what does that highlight?
God.
Jenny, you're throwing your voice. You got this new ventriloquist. No, but I'm talking to you. Jenny, what does that, because you're on the right track. So what does that show us? She's okay.
I'm okay.
She's okay, yes. They freeze up when the microphone gets in their face.
Yeah, now I don't know the answer. Shows us the obviously difference, vast difference between them, and how that's going to impact the outcome of.
We're on the right track. I won't give you the answer right yet. You're on the right track. Keep going. Excessive background narration always signifies something of importance. Now, what do I mean by excessive? The Hebrew narrators are very sparse in their details. You don't get a lot of information. And so when you do, it always is for a purpose. So you should be looking for that. So when you get excessive, like an inordinate, unusual amount of background information, that signifies something important. So, for example, why, ask yourself this question as I read this text. Why does the author give us so much detail about Goliath's armor? Now, let's listen to this. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. That's excessive detail. We get a lot of information about Goliath's armor, which seems to be an insignificant part of the story. And if the author's going to give us detail, there's a lot of other things we would have wanted details about. But why is Goliath's armor get so much attention? Lou, what do you think? Why does Goliath's armor, just talk to us. Don't even worry about mics, okay?
The author is trying to give a picture to the viewers that Goliath's not to be trifled with, or...
Obviously, again, we're adding to the drama, right? If this was Hollywood filming this, it would probably look like something. You'd get a POV shot. You know, that's a point of view from David's perspective. So you see David, right? And he first, the camera looks, begins at his gigantic boots, right? And then very slowly, highlighting and the sun glinting off of these massive pieces of armor, and it's just going up and up from David's viewpoint, right? Till we finally see his fierce face, right? And probably the sun is just in the background glinting off his face. And there's a pull away shot, and we see from a distance, and we see the height difference of Goliath and David. In essence, that's what the author has done, is created that kind of dramatic contrast. As you see, here's a little red-haired shepherd boy with 5 stones and a slingshot, and this massive warrior. So it's adding tremendous drama, but what's the drama pointing to? You see, because Hebrew narration is not interested in drama for drama's sake. It's trying to highlight a point. And I'm not going to let you answer it yet because we're going to keep going. We got some more stuff to talk about here. Okay? Narration, we're continuing. Narrative has a central character, the protagonist. Do you remember this? You probably had this in high school English classes or literature or something. Protagonist, a character that opposes the central character, the antagonist, and usually minor characters that contrast or parallel the central characters. These are called foils. And foils actually play an important role in all storytelling. Disney is famous for their foils, especially in their cartoons. For every cartoon movie, full animation picture they have, there's a main character, right? And there's usually a sidekick. Okay, and that's usually who the kids like the best, and that's who they want to buy the little action figures from, you know. But that sidekick is the foil. And the job of the foil is to, by contrast, highlight the qualities of the hero. So Hebrew narrative has these three general types. We've got a protagonist. And from the protagonist, we're supposed to find out something about the ultimate protagonist, right? Then we have the antagonist, but then we have foils, okay? The protagonist's choices and actions give us insight into his or her character. Therefore, the main object lesson or lessons of the narrative comes from the protagonist's responses to the crises he or she encounters. So what the narrator does is he puts the protagonist in life situations and then lets us see how he or she responds, the choices that are made in those life situations. So in a long narrative, we may have multiple antagonists, right? Now, in the story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife, what role does Potiphar's wife play? Okay, antagonist, or she's actually a foil too. Maybe generally the difference between a foil and an antagonist is the extensiveness of the role. Even though she opposes him, she just briefly on the scene, right? So yes, antagonist, but probably more so a foil. There's something about her character qualities that draw sharp relief to Joseph's character qualities. And that's the role she plays. So as you're reading the narrative, you're asking yourself, what character qualities is the narrator highlighting about this foil? Why? And what does it tell me about the character qualities of the protagonist, the hero of the story? So, Honey Lee, what do we see? What are the character qualities of Potiphar's wife? Give us briefly. She's what? She's tempting, yeah. Yeah, but what do we learn about her character? Honey Lee, what do we learn about her character? What do we learn about her character? Yeah, her character. Or character. Whichever way you want to pronounce it. What do we learn about her character? Lou, were you trying to help out? What do we learn about her character?
She's relentless. She wants to get what she wants.
Okay, relentless is one way to look at it. Huh? She is lustful, yes. Seductress, yes. And what does that reveal about her character? Unhappy? I'm not sure that's what I was going for, but... What? What do we learn? Giselle, what do we learn about her character? Yeah, yeah.
She's wanting a lot of things for her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Harold?
I think she's a liar.
You do?
Yeah. I'm a liar. There's a story in what she said.
Yeah.
It was different from what actually happened.
We know she's a liar, so that, yeah, she's definitely lies. Yeah. That's exactly right. Unfaithful to her covenant.
Yes.
And that's the characteristic that stands out the most. As opposed to Joseph, in stark relief, it shows a man who, in spite of all the situations he's going through, he's faithful to the covenant. You see, so that's the stark relief of that foil. She's willing to throw away that covenant just because of sensual desire. And Joseph holds fast to his covenant relationship with God, which really gives us a key insight into the character of the real, the greater Joseph, who in the midst of much greater temptation remains faithful to God, faithful to his covenant with God, and does not relent to the pressure and the temptation around him, and provides for us the great ultimate model of covenant keeping. You see, so that's what that foil points to. In number six, in Old Testament narrative, there's usually more dialogue than action. Now, this is an interesting thing, and it's different than what we're used to. We get most of our modern stories, most of us watch movies or television shows as opposed to reading, okay? And so movies movies, because it's a visual art form, carry the story primarily through action, and especially modern cinema, less and less through dialogue, right? Through pictures, through images. You know, there's a scene in, what's that movie, is it Up? About the balloon, the old curmudgeon? Up, yeah, right. You know, one of the most powerful scenes is told without any words, right? It's the whole relationship between the husband and his wife, right? I mean, that's one of the most poignant, not just an animated film, but I mean, if you can go through that without crying, I don't know if you're alive or not. Oh yeah, I cry at all movies, regardless. All movies. I've never made it out of a movie without crying yet. Shocking, I know. I'm getting a little verklempt just thinking about it. Movies, so they move the action along with action, as opposed to, they move the story with action as opposed to dialogue. But Old Testament narrative carries most of the story along through dialogue. The speeches are more important than the action. People are portrayed by dialogue, not by the description of the narrator. Therefore, dialogue provides insight into their character. And let's go on to the dialogue section and talk more about that specifically. So the action in a passage is carried mainly by dialogue in Old Testament literature. Action is your fill-in. The action. For example, the most action-packed scene in all Old Testament narrative, maybe all narrative, all Bible narrative, is the David and Goliath scene. I mean, when you think about that, you know, when you're the Sunday school teacher, when the lesson is David and Goliath, you know that week at least, guaranteed, the kids are going to listen. Because that's an exciting story, right? That is the quintessential action-packed story. And yet, in that story, in the English Standard Version, 143 words are narrative or action, and 157 are dialogue. So even that scene, which is the most action-packed scene, 57% of it is just talking. Now, can you imagine an action-packed movie where there's more talking than action? People would want their money back, right? So it tells us something about Old Testament narrative. The dialogue is crucial. So let's look at a few principles related to dialogue. Principle number one, point two, direct speech is the primary method for revealing character and motivation. The author's assumption is that what is significant. I don't know what I was trying to say there. The author's assumption is what is significant about a character can be displayed almost entirely in the character's speech. It's unusual for the author to tell us why the character did something. He gives us the author's dialogue and provides clues that we have to discover for the motivation of why they did something. For example, what I want you to think about, ask yourself as I read this passage, what do we learn about Saul's character in this passage? Through his words, through his dialogue. Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come, let us go back, lest my father cease to care about the donkeys and become anxious about us." Pause for a moment. Do you remember the story? His father has sent him, the donkeys are lost, and sent him to retrieve the donkeys. But he said to him, he is the servant, "Behold, there is a man of God in this city, and he is a man who's held in honor. all that he says comes true. So now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us the way we should go. Then Saul said to his servant, "But if we go, what can we bring the man? For the bread in our sacks is gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" The servant answered Saul again, "Here I have with me a quarter of a shekel of silver, and I will give it to the man of God to tell us our way." And Saul said to the servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So you got to read into the story. What do we learn about the character of Saul from this dialogue? Ramir, what do you got? What's the first thing that that stands out to you? What do we learn about his character?
He was very conscious of trusting in the man of God.
Explain what you're trying to say. Just clarify for me what you mean. I'm not sure what you mean. I don't think so. Go back and try again. Somebody else. Sarah, what do you think?
He's conscious about
Jeff.
What...
It's okay.
I think maybe he's conscious about what people think about him.
Yeah, he is. Exactly. He is deeply concerned about what others think about him. And of course, everything that we learn about his character here, and there are three primary things, will remain true throughout his entire career. We'll see this. And that's number one. Deeply concerned about what others think about him. This is one of the things that's going to lead to his downfall. He cares more about what others think than what God thinks. What else do we find out about him? What else do we find out about him? Joshua?
He honors his brother.
Okay. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. But good try. Yeah. Betta? What do you think? He's what? Yeah. No, I think that's what Ramir was trying to say. I don't think that's accurate. Joanne? Go ahead, try. Yeah. Why? Show me why you think that from the text.
Well, he was asking what could, I don't want to use the word bribe, but what could give the man.
Yeah, and it goes back to what Sarah said. That's really a subset. He's deeply concerned about what others think about him. So how am I going to be perceived? How will they look at me? That's his concern. But there are two other significant things. Mimi, help us. Tell me one.
He's kind of sluggard.
Sluggard, huh? I like that word.
Also strategic.
Strategic? Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah. Orly, what do you think?
He's a very relaxed person.
A what?
Relaxed person.
Relaxed? Yeah, I don't think that's accurate either. Tristan? I think you're looking at it through Filipino rose color, don't want to say anything bad about any person's glasses. I think you have to dig into this text a little bit deeper. Tristan?
Probably manipulating his servants in front of the man of God.
Tell me where, I don't see that, but maybe help me see that.
Servant offered solution, and then Saul said to his servant, "But if you go, continue to the man,
Just a second. Lou, I can't hear. Go ahead, Tristan.
He's supposed to be the, you know, he's supposed to be the leader, so he's supposed to know, you know, if he asked up or what, but he tried to, you know, get something from his servants.
Yeah. I don't think so. Yes, cry, yeah. Joanne wants to try again too, and then that table. Oh, I mean, that's Sonny's first. Go ahead. I called her, and then I'll get you, Joanne.
Opportunist.
Why do you see that?
Well, I see him as saying, let's go back, because my father won't care about the donkey. So the reason why he was sent out was to get the donkeys back, but if they took too long, then he won't have favor with his dad. So let's go back already, because anyway, we can't find the donkey. So I'm just thinking that he might be in his position.
Yeah.
He takes too long to go home, and he wants to get favor from his father, and he's afraid that if he's gone too long, he might, you know, it's just a...
I think you're somewhat on the right track, but not quite there. So. Joanne? Impatient, why do you see that? Does he? I'm not so sure. Yeah. Merle, what do you think?
I think he's more of a person whose decision is influenced.
Exactly right. That's number two. He's greatly influenced by the words of others. Who's running the show here?
The servant.
The servant. Yeah. His words influence Saul. He's greatly influenced by the words of others, you see. And again, we're going to see that all throughout his career. That's going to be his downfall in his role. Great, we've got two of them. It took us a while, but this is learning a new art, a new skill of how to read into this narrative and find out what's really being communicated. So there's one more. Sonny started, kind of took the first step down the right path and then spun around in circles. But what do you think? One more thing. Giselle, you want to try?
Can I say that?
You can say it. You can say that? The servant's carrying the petty cash, you know. Don't the administrators handle the petty cash? You know that. No. Yeah, Tristan.
Maybe he also thinks about how he looked his relationship with his father.
Say what?
I didn't hear. His relationship with his dad and his father.
I think that fits under the category concerned about what others are going to think about him. But what's one other quality that we see? Yeah, go ahead, Kenneth, give it a shot. I appreciate your boldness.
Okay. It's not for theory, because they're objective by they go there out. Just to find the documents. But they, he said that, let us go down this entire system here. So it's not somehow by people.
Yeah. I think you're with Sonny. You started on that path, and you're heading in the right direction. Yeah, Merle? What? Go ahead.
So always forget the main purpose why he's
there. We're so close. We're so close. Merle? Marielle?
It appears to me that he's cynical. Like he was asked to look for the donkeys. They couldn't find it. So he wanted to give up. And then when the servant proposed and they consoled the man of God, he looked at the negative side, which is, you don't have anything to give him.
Yeah. I don't think it's cynical. Harold?
I'm just trying to make his own way. I mean, you're given objective A, and then there's an alternative B.
I'll tell you what, we're at our break time. When the food smell comes in, I know it's time to break. Let me tell you, you've been real close, but he's a man uncertain about which way to go. He's uncertain about which way to go. You see the uncertainty. Let's go back. Okay, well, let's go forward. But what should we go forward, or what will we do? And what will happen when we get there? Uncertain about which way to go. That basic uncertainty to make a decision. Which, Sonny, you started there, and Kenneth and Mary Lee, you're hitting on it. Yeah, but it's an uncertainty, but I just don't know what decision to make, an unwillingness to make a quality decision and to follow through with it. And you see, all three of those characteristics, we see those will haunt him through his life, and they provide a contrast to the major foe in his life, which is David, right? Who is clearly a man who knows the direction to go in, a man who's not influenced by the words of others, and a person who cares more about what God thinks than what others think, you see? All right, 10 o'clock, take a break, and we'll be back at 10.